Tonight on Arena, Rememberings is the new memoir from Sinead O'Connor. Lise Hand will be here to review it. And Robin Wright on directing and starring in her new feature film, Land. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In the beginning, there was the voice and the look. In 1987, Sinead O'Connor seemed to come out of nowhere when she released the single Mandinka and the album The Lion and the Cobra. She made an impact straight away. She was just 21. Since then, she has remained beloved and controversial in equal parts, and one of the most important singers and songwriters of the age. Rememberings, her new memoir, is without doubt one of the most anticipated books of 2021. Lise Hand has been reading it for us, and she joins me now. If you just had to describe the book to start out, Lise, what would you say we have in Rememberings?
Well, I think if anyone is expecting a straightforward, conventional, traditional class of autobiography, which begins with, you know, her early years and goes in a kind of progressive line through her life, through her personal life, through her professional life, and so on to where she is today, they ain't getting that. I would describe it nearly as a kind of a selected history. It's a series of vignettes and interwoven with explications about the, you know, the process of her art, reminiscences, a few stories from the road. I mean, a bit like herself. It's such a book of contrariness and contradictions. It's, you know, it's candid and it's careful, and you know, you get obviously some controversy. It has a few shocking passages, and then you get glimpses of absolute brilliance and then flashes of absolute great humour as well.
Yeah, it's very funny in places. You said you're not going to get conventional, you're not going to get straightforward, and you're not going to get traditional. Well, you're not going to get that from Sinead O'Connor at any time, really, are you?
Absolutely not. I mean, it would have been, I think, a bigger shock if she had turned in a conventional style book. But, you know, it is really interesting. And, you know, anything Sinead does, you know, you kind of pay attention to it. And, you know, she does, I think, give us sort of clues along the way, you know, in among sort of some of the more careful prose. You know, you do kind of get clues into what makes her tick. You know, at one stage she says, you know, there's nothing I could write in this book or tell you that would help you to get to know me. And then she says, as Yeats said, one cannot separate the dancer from the dance. And in a way, you know, the story of Sinead is so in, you know, Sinead the person is so in, you know, intrinsic and in sort of, it cannot be separated out from Sinead, the you know, the great artist.
What do you recall, Elise, of her arrival, Sinead O'Connor's arrival on the music scene in 1987?
Well, I mean, it was an extraordinary time. I mean, I was actually working as a rock critic at the time, and I interviewed her actually around the time of Lion and the Cobra. And I mean, I was just blown away by that album. I really was. It's one of those great albums that sort of just changes, you know, how you kind of think about music and, you know, how you sort of regard an artist. And it's held up brilliantly, which I think is a great mark to the album itself. But there never really had been anything else like it. And of course, she was this extraordinary figure at a time when the Irish music scene was absolutely almost exclusively and entirely dominated by men. There were some women bands, some great women bands. I mean, you had bands like Intuanu and you had singers like Flo McSweeney. You know, you had some great ones, but really Sinead was something completely different. And it was everything from her look to the way she disports herself, and then to the music she created.
Quite early, the early section of the book really deals to a large extent with her family and with her childhood. What Sinead do we get here, and how open, how honest, and maybe even how guarded is she in that section?
Again, it's a mixture. She says in the prologue of the book that she is going to let the child speak in the first section. And that's very much what she does to a certain extent. It's almost like viewing what unfolded in the family home with through the eyes of a child. It's quite sort of almost passive. She's telling stories, but she's not maybe putting them in kind of context, or she's just sort of telling what she sees and explaining what happened to her. You know, so again, some of the passages about, you know, the trauma that she went through with her mother is you know, it's upsetting to read, and it's quite gut-wrenching at times. And she is fairly circumspect about her family. She doesn't really go into any great detail about family life other than that particular situation with her other siblings. She really does sort of small affectionate pen portraits of them, but really doesn't kind of go into the relationships. I mean, it's actually sort of quite sad, I thought, when I was reading the book, that, you know, one of the stories that she tells about herself and her three siblings together as a family was actually when they went on an expedition into town, into Dun's Stores, to buy a dress for their mother to be buried in after she died in a car crash. But I think she is, you know, she is quite guarded about that. You get flashes, but, you know, not great detail.
And she does speak about her sister, Eamon, and a great story.
With great affection.
And a great story about stomping on a chocolate Santa, which I think it seems they continue to this day. It's a kind of a family tradition that's carried into Easter eggs as well.
Exactly.
And there's clear, affection for her brother Joseph and his writing, but it's she states it clearly and she moves on to her own story, which I guess is perfectly acceptable.
Oh yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, every artist approaches a biography differently or an autobiography differently. Some would spend an awful lot of time on their childhood and how it shaped and how their early years shaped, you know, were formative to shaping the artist or the creative person within. Sinead sort of moves past that and kind of, you know, gets into the story of her life. We get, you know, and again, there are obviously there's actually large sections of the story of her life missing. I mean, she explains that she actually left out between 1992 and 2015 because she had undergone major surgery and then had a total breakdown, as she explains in the book. So again, it's not sort of linear, it sort of jumps around a bit. But, you know, again, the book is full of really interesting insights and and great stories.
Yeah, because there are lots of relationships, that there was so much stuff in the papers and all sorts of speculation around all kinds of things. She avoids all of that by simply saying, I'm putting down here what I remember. There are certain relationships, I'm just not talking about them because the other people are involved and I respect their privacy as well. Yeah. Is she letting herself off the hook there, or is that perfectly acceptable and the right way to approach it?
That's a good question. I think she's just concentrating, you know, she steered clear of that. I mean, obviously, maybe there was just too much trauma there and she didn't want to involve other people, drag people into her story because they're their stories to tell, not necessarily hers as well. So I think she's probably respecting that. And, I think that was a decision that she made somewhere along the way. I think that, but the thing that struck me, Sean, I have to say, is that, you know, every now and then you come across, there's a writer in Sinead. I mean, you can see flashes of where the luminance, sort of brilliance of her brother, you know, Joe as a writer. You can just see flashes. She has the most amazing, brilliant turns of phrase. I mean, I just, you know, there was a couple, she was talking about her grandparents and she said, in the evenings, he and my grandma used to go out on their own together for a glass of porter because they're in love. You know, like a sentence like that. I mean, you know, I'd kill to write a sentence like that, you know.
And one struck me too when she writes about Bob Dylan quite early on in the book, and she says, he's as beautiful as if God blew a breath from Lebanon and it became a man.
Oh, you know. Yeah, no, I mean, she really has a gorgeous, some absolutely gorgeous turns of phrase. And one of my favourite lines, put down lines, I think, was in that mad bonkers chapter about her encounter with Prince, which is just, I mean, the book is worthwhile just getting for that alone, because it's one of those stories that it's so bananas. It has to be true.
You know, she wouldn't tell Brendan O'Connor this. She said, no, you can read it in the book, but I can ask you to give us the essence of the story.
Essentially, she's in Hollywood. She gets a call inviting her to go to Prince's house in the Hollywood Hills. And so she's picked up in a car and whisked up. And just from the moment the door opens, it's just this sort of bizarre scene. I mean, it kind of reminded me a little bit of like the Rocky Horror Picture Show or something, you know, and sort of this sort of creepy house, semi-dark, with this sort of very odd, nervous servant and who's trying to serve her soup. And, you know, and Prince starts sort of giving out to her for swearing in interviews. And, you know, the whole thing gets really kind of fraught and, you know, really hectic. And then but again, it's her humour that saves her. I mean, at one stage, She says, at one point, himself decides we need to calm down and he goes upstairs. I'm thinking presumably to powder his nose and make sure Dorian Gray's portrait is still OK in the attic.
I know.
I mean, it's such a great
line. There's another great line in that too, where, and this she says has the ring of truth of it, where she quotes and she says, Prince himself, as she refers to him, himself said to me, you must be Shine Aid, spelled S-H-I-N-E-A-I-D. And she says, you must be Prance, P-R-A-N-C-E. I mean, great humour throughout.
Fantastic.
I mean, she really has it. And whether that happened or not is a moot point. We can't corroborate it really, but it's a great story.
It's a great story. It's one of those ones, and I love the way she tells it. And again, there's so many different styles in the book. And I mean, that is very much has the style of like one of your girlfriends coming into a pub and saying, wait until I tell you what happened. So, it's that sort of almost kind of, it was a horrible situation, but she tells it with great relish and she can sort of, she carries it off really well.
Yeah, there certainly was a darkness to the situation, not a situation you'd like to find yourself in.
Yeah.
She talks, and I quoted it when I was leading into the programme tonight, this idea that, there are the two voices before the turning of the picture in 1992, the picture of the Pope, and afterwards, or before and after SNL, Saturday Night Live. Did you get a sense of two different voices in the book in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense of, I think there's actually several different voices. The tone does change, and, a lot of the first-hand reminiscences are in the present tense as well, to give it that sort of immediacy and observational thing. But, there's a more conventional tone in the second half of the book to a certain extent. And again, it's really, there's some really interesting stuff about the sexism in the music industry, which is right, was rife and probably still is to a certain degree, and how the various music execs tried to bend her to their will when it came to her, her life and her image and so on, suggesting that she kind of pretty herself up and so on. And, her manager at the time, Faulkner, just said, I think you should go and shave your head. And off she went. And there's a very funny, sort of description of trying to persuade the distraught hairdresser or barber to shear her hair. And again, when she got pregnant with her first child, Jake, again, there was a suggestion that, that the record company had put a lot of money into furthering her career and it was only getting off the ground and she should have an abortion. And of course, she didn't. So there's, there's sort of, what I thought was quite interesting as well, she kind of casually talks about, there was lots of sex when you're on the road and so on like that. And that's very unusual to hear a woman sort of say that in a kind of very casual way.
Yeah.
There's no kind of big sort of hand-wringing about it. Oh, God, I can't believe I did that one night. It's like, there was lots of sex on the road. All the girls, we go to the guy's bus and, and
what
it was just
happens on tour stays on tour.
Absolutely. And, I quite sort of thought that, instead of the usual sort of hand-wringing and tiptoeing around it, she just kind of says it. But this, of course, is what Sinead does. I mean, she...
Yeah. Does she really examine her own artistic process, if you like? Do we get any sense about how she wrote some of the songs that she wrote or how she performed some of the songs that were written for her by others?
Yeah, I mean, she does sort of, there is a section where she goes through the different albums and talks about who she collaborated with and, some of the process of songwriting. But... she even herself kind of said that, more or less saying, writing about music is really difficult. And, it doesn't sort of explain certainly how that first album and probably the follow up, came from. And again, there's this sort of wonderful contradiction in the book that, you have the sort of, we all know the chaotic backdrop of her own sort of personal life. And then you have this artist who, even at a young age, was incredibly focused. Before she went into the studio record Lion the Cobra, she kind of worked out her voice level so that, well beforehand, so that, even the whispers would be picked up in the studio.
Yeah.
And when it was suggested that her second album, I Don't Know What, wasn't suitable because it was too sort of diary-like and too personal, she just scoffed. Now, for a sort of a young artist to sort of have that belief, and this is the thing, whatever happened in sort of Sinead's own life, her belief in her ability to produce music and her faith in that music was unwavering.
How does she handle the question of her own mental health?
She, it's again, it's... you know, there's no one particular line. I mean, she might sort of, you know, on a few occasions she'll sort of say, you know, I had a difficult relationship with X, but, you know, I was very difficult to live with. And, you know, she will sort of make statements like that. But there's sort of no kind of delving into it to a huge degree. And I mean, I am thankful for one thing, that I've read far too many memoirs by, we'll say, you know, high profile people that are only ruined because they're completely sort of, you know, enmeshed in therapy speak and so on.
Yeah.
And you never get that. I mean, which I think is a merciful thing.
Yeah.
She never lapses into that sort of, or retreats behind or hides behind that sort of that therapy speak. You know, you hear, she will say things and it's, she's just said it. That's
and
take it or leave it.
It feels like her speaking to her. Well, certainly with the bits that I was
absolutely
reading, it feels like her speaking directly to us. One final question just on how does she handle her questions around faith and her questions around religion?
Oh, yeah. I mean, religion, you know, it's quite clear that even as a child, you know, she became, you know, very kind of wrapped up in religion. And she, you know, it played a massive sort of role in her life as a child. She doesn't dwell on it enormously. I mean, you know, for instance, again, you know, the stuff that didn't make it in, you know, there was no sort of mention about at all about the fact that she became a priest, you know, Father Michael, Bishop Michael Cox ordained her. God, I can't remember the terminology. Yeah, ordained her. I think it was 1999. And, you know, there is some mention of her conversion to Islam, where she, you know, which seems to have brought her great peace. And she describes it as, actually, I think she describes it as not converting, but reverting, because she felt like she was coming home. And, you know, you get the sense at the end of the book that, you know, she has made her peace with herself to a huge extent. And, you know, she got to a sort of a place where she could sort of write, you know, some of this book anyway.
Yeah.
You know, again, I wonder what if it, like a really stern editor had sat down and said, right, I want you to tell me about this, that and the other, and let's do that. You know, would maybe the book have benefited from another pair of eyes kind of to guide her, to bring more out of her on certain things? But then again, I mean, she's had such a full and fabulous life. I mean, God knows there could be volume 2 and 3 and 4.
Yeah, well, I've heard lots of references to first memoir, so maybe there's more to
absolutely
come. Recommendation from you, Lise, is it?
No, absolutely. I mean, if you want to just, you know, have another dose of Sinead's sort of great, you know, unexpectedness. It's definitely a book worth picking up.
Yeah, and ordained into the Tridentine Order. That was what you were talking about.
Yeah, I could not get the lingo right. Sorry about that. I'm going to hell anyway, so what can I say?
Well, not for that. Not for your review of the book, that's for sure. Lise, thanks for speaking with us this evening. That's Lise Hand speaking to us about Rememberings by Sinead O'Connor, which is published by Sandy Cove Press. And let's go right back to the very beginning and that single we spoke about, Mandinka. Mandinka from Sinead O'Connor, and Rememberings, the book that we were speaking about earlier on with Lise Hand. The film Land is the feature film directorial debut of actress and star of House of Cards, Forrest Gump and The Princess Bride, Robin Wright. Based on a play by Jesse Chatham and Erin Dignam, Land is the story of a bereaved woman, Edie, also played by Wright, who tries to come to terms with her grief by engaging with nature in the wilderness of Wyoming. She's badly equipped for survival in this rugged terrain and is found almost starved to death by local man Miguel, played by Damian Bashir, and Nurse Alawa, played by Sarah Dawn Pledge.
I know I would be more comfortable if you came into the hospital. Do you know how lucky you've been? You would have died if it weren't for Miguel. If he hadn't found you, didn't call me, Miguel will bring you your results, as I assume you won't be coming into town to get them.
Here, take this cell phone. Because you need help?
Yeah. You know, we've been polite enough not to ask you all the questions one might want to ask if they found someone like you. No phone, One might begin to wonder how she came to be in this place. Might wonder if she's hiding from someone.
I understand your curiosity. I'm not running from anyone. I'm not hiding. I'm not a criminal. I'm here because I choose to be.
Robin Wright, Damien Bashir and Sarah Dawn Pledge there in a scene from Land. Recently I spoke to Robin Wright and her co-star Damien Bashir about Land, the story of Edie and filming in the wilderness. Robin, you first became involved in this project as a director only. What attracted you as a director, first of all?
The end of the movie's message was so powerful, and I just felt like that being, you know, the power of human resilience. We all go through difficult times in varying degrees and experience loss and grief. And we do have the power in us to come through the other side. But generally, it takes the kindness and empathy and compassion of another human being that basically helps guide you through. And I just loved how positive and hopeful that is. And right now, I felt like we needed that message in the world.
Certainly kindness is so important. And Demian, there's a line that your character utters quite early on in the film, and I really sat up when I heard it. The Edie, Robin's character, because she's also acting in this, and we'll come back to that, asks, you know, why are you being kind to me? That word kindness comes in. And he simply says, because you were in my path. It's an extraordinary statement. It tells us lots about the movie. But it also tells us lots about Miguel.
It's one of the things that when I read the script, it was that one line, you know, and Robin agrees on that. That's what it got her also. It's just such a plain, beautiful, simple line that define us as humans, because that's who we are. We are that. We are not, you know, what we sometimes experience, you know, when we are selfish and with discrimination or racism or stupidity. That's who we are. And that as you very well put it, that defines Miguel. How many times we have that opportunity of helping others and we just turn around and go away? How many of us stay and help other people, a total stranger, without asking any questions? So that's one of the most beautiful parts of the film.
And Robin, Miguel, the character, has quite a task to get through to Edie. She's not open to kindness. She's open to very little in the early parts of the movie, and we find out why as time goes on. But to put on the actor's hat, then, she is carrying a lot of pain, the character of Edie.
Yes. And, you know, some people would ask, well, is she going to survive or is she going for suicide? And I don't think she knows. She just thinks, I'm going to go to this place that is basically honoring the dream that she and her family always had together, was to go live there. And it's almost like an homage, because she could have gone to an island. Or right, or desert, or why the mountains? So, and then there's all the metaphors and symbolism of nature, that it's healing. It's a very healing, it's got healing properties. And people, I think, are feeling that more than ever right now, just in this isolated year that we've all been in.
Let's listen to a clip from Land featuring Robin Wright as Edie, Demian Bashir as Miguel. And this is a section where she certainly doesn't want any interference, Edie, but towards the end, she begins to loosen up just a little bit.
Can we agree that my actions are my business?
Yes, we can.
And if I end up starving, well, that's on me.
I feel that I have to say this. Only a person who has never been hungry would think starving is a way to die. There are better ways to die.
There are better ways to die?
I understand it might be a little rough for you here, but if you feel you don't belong here, then...
If I don't belong here, I don't belong anywhere.
Have you ever killed anything?
No. A fish.
If it's all right, I will come back here and teach you how to trap. In the fall, to hunt. And then you won't see me anymore.
Okay.
Robin Wright and Demian Bashir there in a clip from the film Land, both with me this evening. And Robin Wright, both director and actor in this particular script. As I say, just as we come towards the end of that, we hear that, yeah, she's agreed now that she'll be taught how to hunt and how to trap, which brings us to the mountainside and the task that you had, first of all, as actors, to just eventually become comfortable with really survival techniques. Was there much involved, Robin, in actually learning those for you as an actor?
Oh, yes. we had our training days with our mountain men that taught us how to chop wood, which we thought was going to be a breeze. It's really difficult. And you do get blisters on your hands in about, what would you say, 60 seconds if you don't have gloves on, things like that. But we were taught how to... even though we didn't do it, but, you know, educate on how to hunt and how to skin a deer and how to smoke the meat. And, boy, can we make a fire, right, Damien? We are some good old fire builders now.
We can do it now.
Were you educated, Damien, in how to stay warm in what must have been weather that changed, you know, by the second from maybe not blistering heat, but certainly from kind of manageable to blizzard-like conditions? How did you manage with that?
Well, you can only imagine how difficult that is for a tropical fish like myself. it's always a challenge, you know. Anything below 20 Celsius, it's too much for me. So, but, you know, once you're up there, you forget about those weather conditions. It's so beautiful, that's so overwhelmingly beautiful that... you just embrace it. And one of the things that our mountain taught us was not only how to hunt and how to fish and how to build traps and how to chop wood and all that, but how to become one with nature, how to blend in and through respect, how to live in communion, you know, with everything that is around you. And that was really beautiful, you know, and it was so helpful for me, you know, to play Miguel, because he's almost like a saint.
You had it easy, Demian. You know, when they were off setting up for the next scene, you could go over and practice your axe swinging technique so that you could look brilliant. You didn't have it like that, Robin. You had to go off and set up the next scene. And what really amazed me about this, you know, actor directors, yes, we've seen this before. You had directed before. You had directed in House of Cards, obviously, and directed yourself in that. But in this case, you were at times as the actor, you were in this really difficult emotional state. And presumably you had to finish that and say, right, that's a take. Let's go, guys. Let's start for the next setup. How difficult was it to switch from one to the other, given the level of emotion that's involved in the story?
I mean, it is more like a light switch when you're doing both. And you just flip the switch on when you have to get in front of the camera. And sometimes I would just say, can you clear the set, or everybody get out of the cab and just give me 60 seconds. You know, you prepare. And but to tell you the truth, I generally only had one take in me most of the time. And then it was like, I'm done. Yeah, I can't do that anymore. I can't get to that level of emotion for a take two. So we also, our schedule was so crammed. It was so tight. We shot the whole movie in 29 days. So we didn't have a lot of time to prepare, you know, or rehearse or anything. Damien and I didn't even rehearse. We met each other once, and then a month later he showed up the first day to shoot.
I suppose that comes back to the nature of your character in some ways, Damien, that he has that facility to sit and wait. That's what the film does. That's what your character does.
That's what we need, you know, and boy, did we have that over the last year. Time to think of everything we do.
It's been a privilege to speak with both of you this evening. The film is absolutely beautiful. I'm going to finish with a clip of your singing. This is beautiful singing. I don't know why Robin, your character, gives out to Demian about his singing in this particular section. But do you remember the scene, the one where you sing?
Yeah. Oh, we remember that, yeah.
Let's have a listen.
We will find you, acting on your best behavior. And you're not turn your back in Mother Nature. We will find you. Acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule the world. There's a room where the light won't find you. Holding hands when the walls come tumbling down. When they do, I'll be right behind you. So sad we almost made it. So sad we had to fade it. Everybody wants to rule the world.
Clearly enjoying themselves there, Damien Bashir and Robin Wright, in a scene from Land, also directed by Robin Wright. And that film opens in Irish cinemas, we can say that now, on June the 7th. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. What can be better than having our galleries back open to the public? Well, I guess a new exhibition of work by a respected artist to attract the public in. That's the plan of the Hugh Lane Gallery, who are hosting a new exhibition of work by Maud Cotter. It's called A Consequence of a Dappled World, a reference to Nancy Cartwright's book, The Dappled World, A Study of the Boundaries of Science. And delighted to have Maud Cotter join me this evening. Maud, this is a work that's been evolving over quite a bit of time. Started out as an exhibition in Limerick City Gallery, and then in the dock in Leitrim, in Carrick and Shannon in Leitrim. How has it developed? What was the initial idea, and how has that grown into what I think is a much bigger exhibition now upcoming at the Hugh Lane?
Well, I think I was taking myself in hand, really, and sort of deciding what I needed to do to push forward ideas in my practice. So I decided to do a body of work over a longer period of time, just increasing my concentration there. So I evolved it, if you like, through three venues. But to start with, I chose a title which was Consequence Of, because I was really concerned in the work with the consequence, the acceleration of consequence in our contemporary world. And I was asking myself very much, how does sculpture answer questions, or how do the visual arts make manifest things that add to what we understand of our physical environment?
So the catalogue to the work now that's been presented in the Hugh Lane then, it talks about how you're setting up an exchange really between very humble, rudimentary, everyday objects, and then a whole series of abstract and conceptual models, really. So talk to me a little bit about the, I suppose, some of those humble and everyday objects that you've chosen to use.
I suppose I'm interested in the idea of building consciousness and a deep, deep, deep-seated change. So I see that change emanating from something almost at a molecular level. So it comes really from the bottom up, you know, through different scales of objects. I'm also interested in the agency of detritus, really, what we consider to be inanimate. But of course, they are animate and they do have agency of their own. So I'm very interested in spending time with found objects and finding that moment where I could then, if you like, add to that through my own sort of, maybe it's a porous structure I was adding to it, and something of the sort of undress of that detritus just met it, you know?
Yeah, well, tell me about the specifics, say, of the work Slit, which I think will give people something to ground those ideas in.
Well, Slit was very specific to a slit in the wall. In the central atrium between the old building, Charlemont House, and the new galleries is a very sort of a space that's full of slippage. And one wall is like a hanging wall and it has a slit in it. And I thought of, I was listening to a lot of lectures at, just before COVID broke out on virus. And I was always very interested in the form of disease as an active agent, especially in its propensity to propagate itself and just the sheer energy of that. So I thought I'd do something about the way that a virus enters the body. And I use this sort of metaphorical notion of, say, the idea that the virus holds a key with which it enters the body. And then, if you like, the metaphorical device of a knife with which it leaves the body. And while it's in the body, it mutates. So in a way, I wanted to have a piece that did sort of cut into the wall. And it's a lined piece that cuts into that slit and runs up the wall. And on top of the points, it's rather like a tree. There are little stands, and on these little stands are cut hot water bottles filled with plaster and then with a kind of a flaccid balloon hanging out of it. And I see, in a way, I see the water bottle and the balloon as being some sort of spent human presence, you know, that's what's left after the mutation.
It also amazes me, and I've spoken to in several different art forms, people who have been working around something. I think the ideas around a disease and virus, it's not particularly something that just happened suddenly in terms of your interest in it. But it has amazed me the number of people who were working around something in the area or with these type of ideas in mind that suddenly became way more relevant with COVID. Were you surprised by that? And did it change how you approached your ideas, particularly in slit and the water bottles and that slit in the wall?
I was surprised at the you know, because I was interested in the kind of the acceleration of consequence. But in some ways, those kind of generative and ideas, I found a book, believe it or not, in 1974 in a secondhand bookstore in New York, which was titled Rats, Lice and History. And it was the biography of typhus. And it described it as a sort of an intelligence, really, a discerning propagative force. And I always liked that, you know. I mean, it itself has a swarm about it, like a drawing or something. So I was using that idea in my work prior to it, and I made a piece in 2004, which was pretty much based on that. So that's been part of my work, but not unlike the forces and serial motion of, say, somebody like Eva Hesse. You know, so it's something sculptors have been using, the accumulation of elements as a force. So I would say that was inherent in the work before the immediate run into COVID. But I was kind of surprised that the dislocation of reality, in a way, and our lack of traction in terms of thinking, I certainly experienced that. I think it made it more relevant for me to make work and to create pieces that, if you like, explored vistas that may be something we need to deal with in the future. One of my pieces, The Moon is Falling, is a dystopian landscape. It's like everything has fallen away to two registers. On the floor are sort of structures that look a little bit like elemental buildings, and they're actually welded hoops of plastic. And then on top are floating ovals made of styrofoam, and if you could, they look like cakes, actually. I mean, if you imagine the plaster just pouring over those ovals and dripping, so it looks like a fungal layer or a lunar layer, and it's very much about that point, or something that has to be imagined, that we reduce the Earth to very, yeah. very limited register.
Finally, Maud, I said at the beginning that there's a reference or in some ways maybe a response to Nancy Cartwright in your work. Cartwright yeah. wrote The Dappled World, a work that really argues yeah. around this notion that the world can be completely ordered by one single elegant mathematical theory. She argues against that. Are you in accord with her on that?
I am indeed. And I was very attracted to her ideas, you know, that she considers that the world has pockets of great precision. But, you know, precision and quantifiable ways of thinking does not govern the whole world. There are large amounts of qualitative things, as we've mm-hmm. experienced in terms of, like, say, for example, social cohesion during the COVID. But, like, also she describes, this is a description of physical reality. This is why it interests me as a sculptor, that the world has a sort of variation. And she talks about the ragged edges and the world as being something that's jumbled, a jumbled world of material things. She's referencing Gerard Manley Hopkins, of course, and his poem, Pied Beauty. And he says, like, things like, all things counter, original, spare and strange. And I think that was the sentence that just really caught her eye. You know, this idea of something spare, strange, some things original, some things counter. So the diversity really, you know, as he says, what is fickle, freckled, who knows how. You know, so there is this question of the variation and the variety. Yeah. And the variation and the variety is really the driving force, you know?
Yeah. Well, thanks for speaking with us this evening, Maud. That's Maud Cotter, and the exhibition, A Consequence of A Dappled World, is at the Huillain Gallery from June the 2nd, that's tomorrow, through until August the 8th. On Friday of last week, Moby released his 19th studio album entitled Reprise. The album features the Budapest Art Orchestra alongside a variety of guest artists performing acoustic and orchestral arrangements of songs from Moby's long career, including this one featuring Chris Christopherson and Mark Lanigan. This is The Lonely Night.
And when the windows shutter, it's always dark inside. Sometimes the pain is absurd, still it's what fate decides. Thought I saw Jesus come down, dressed like a soldier.
Little taste there of The Lonely Night from a new album from Moby featuring the Budapest Art Orchestra, and that track featuring Chris Christopherson and Mark Lanigan. This weekend, St. Flannan's Cathedral in Killaloe, County Clare, plays host to the 9th annual Killaloe Music Festival. A series of free live stream concerts will be presented by RTÉ Lyric FM's Paul Herriot and will feature music from Bach, Mozart to Mendelssohn, and a world premiere by composer Malachy Robinson and double bass player to boot. The list of performers is equally impressive. Carol McGonnell on clarinet, Diane Daly on violin, as is Sean Milne, Joachim Rauer on viola, Christopher Ellis on cello. The festival's artistic director for 2021 is Catherine Hunke, who's spoken to us in previous appearances on this programme as the leader of the Irish Chamber Orchestra, but this weekend she wears a very different hat, and delighted to be speaking to her about just that. This is the big chance now, Catherine. You've been sitting there maybe over the years saying, do you know what they should be playing at this festival? Do you know what piece they should have on the programme for this festival? Now, there you go. Then they put it up to you. Now, off you go and programme a festival for us. Did you have any sort of... Did you have any guiding thoughts? Go ahead, Catherine, sorry.
Well, it was kind of the opposite for me. When I was phoned up about being artistic director when I was in Lidl shopping. And I said, no way. Because I've never done anything like this before. And I thought that it was something that I wouldn't be able to do. You know that nagging self-doubt that that can raise its ugly head.
Oh, yeah.
And then as soon as I started to, I kind of realized by the time I got to the fizzy water section, I realized that there was no way that I was going to turn this down. I mean, what an idiot.
Yeah.
So I said, yes, of course. And then it's just been incredibly exciting and fun thing to be doing, because you get to choose the music you play.
That's what I would have thought would be the most exciting part for you. I'm sure you play loads of repertoire, both in the orchestra and in various different ensembles that you'd be involved in that you love playing. But to actually get to choose maybe even pieces that normally you wouldn't get to play or that you mightn't even be involved in playing. Was there some sort of guiding force through that? Or was it simply, great, Catherine Hunke, my greatest hits, here we go.
Well, I think initially it's like that. It's like you're in a sweet shop and you just want everything on the programme. And then you realise very quickly that that's not going to work at all. And yeah. So you pare it down and you pare it down and you pare it down. And of course, the COVID outbreak meant we sort of reimagined it, the festival, because we're very much celebrating the wonderful Irish people that are here and that are willing to come back and quarantine. Mm. So we're so lucky to have Carol McGonnell and Chris Ellis and Finian Collins all gracing the doors of the cathedral. So now it's become a festival of people I love playing music. Yes, of course, music I absolutely love. And I suppose I began with the music of J.S. Bach at the heart of this. Because imagine being in a beautiful cathedral listening to the music of J.S. Bach.
Yeah.
We're beginning with him.
Yeah, and that is the and you, is it the it's the Chaconne from Partita number 2 in D minor. I think you're playing that.
Yeah. So it's just a bit of a different thing because this lady called Helga Turner, who is a German lady, she believes that Bach hid messages in there as a present to his wife. He actually had a few wives, but as a present to his wife, he hid some messages in there of cantatas that he'd written. And so I'm actually doing a version arranged by Helga, which is for choir and fiddle. So the choir sing the bits of Bach that are sort of hidden, like Da Vinci Code, in the music. And it's incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, and sort of, tell me a bit about the vocal ensemble. It's yourself on violin, Catherine. Is the vocal ensemble. Who are they?
Well, they're a very special group of people. They're people who originally met in the youth choir and the Irish youth choir and became very close friends. And then decided that they needed to form their own group to give themselves the chance to sing this sort of wonderful stuff. And so they do lots of different things and they draw upon a pool of singers. So there's 8 of them coming to sing this year at the festival, and it's quality singing. It's beautiful, beautiful, thoughtful singing.
I want to play
They're going to be singing the Bach.
Yeah, but so that's the Bach piece. I want to play a little piece from which is further into the programme. This is a Dohnányi sextet in C major. Really unusual instrumentation here. 6 of them, obviously. Are you involved in the playing here?
Yes, I'm going to play in this. Viola and cello and me. And then a horn, who's Hannah Miller, who's an incredibly wonderful Irish horn player who is only here because the Juilliard isn't up and running. She's supposed to be at the Juilliard right now studying. And Carol McGonnell on clarinet and Finian on the piano. So it's going to be real. Yeah. It's a really fun piece. It's mental.
Yeah, I have a little bit of the final movement here. This is from a Berlin group called Spectrum Concerts, but it gives us a sense of just the fun that is in this music and particularly in that final movement. Oh, that is such fun, isn't it? A section there from the final movement of Dohnányi's Sextet in C major. And that's one of the pieces that will be played at this year's Killaloe Music Festival. And the new artistic director, or the director for this year's festival, Catherine Hunke, is speaking to me this evening. There are times there that it sounds like a lot more than 6 instruments, we were saying as we were listening, Catherine. And I'm guessing in the cathedral, in that open space, it will sound even bigger again.
Yeah, it's going to be huge. You know, we have to do a festival this year that jumps out at people's screens because, you know, it's going to be, for most people, it's going to be an on-screen experience this year.
Mm.
And so then it needs to jump out. It needs to be colourful and a lot of fun and, you know, really vibrant performances, which is, that's exactly what we're going to do.
Yeah, is there a piece that, is it an Asai piece that Diane Daly is performing that involves, is there a lighting aspect to what we're seeing as well, or what we will see on our screens?
Well, that's what would have happened if people had been in the cathedral. But what she's done is extraordinary response to our times. And she's actually done a version where she's going to be in lots of different venues around where we live. So she's going to be in fields and valleys and the cathedral playing this extraordinarily beautiful piece of music for solo fiddle by Isai, Belgian guy. And I can only ask people to watch. It's the late night concert on Friday night, because it really will be unlike anything you've seen before. Pushing boundaries. She really is.
I'll watch out and listen out for that for sure. And finally then, Malachy Robinson, known well as a double bass player, a new composition from Malachy.
Yes. So he has collaborated with his cousin Jane, who was already a poet who's published things. She's a really wonderful way with words, beautiful. And she wrote some poems with him together. He's written music in response to poems about, I suppose, in essence, what us humans are doing to nature. And I just thought it wouldn't it wouldn't go amiss this year with everything we've been dealing with, just to spend a moment with that subject. So that's also going to happen. It's a premiere on Saturday night.
Well, listen,
and that's with Far Flung Trio, which is me and Dermot and Malachy.
Well, Dermot Dunn on the
accordion.
Dermot
Dunn, fabulous.
Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of things went through your head between the door of Lidl and the fizzy water section, didn't they? Congratulations on that. I'm glad that you decided to say yes at the fizzy water section.
Too.
Great to speak with you, Catherine. And this artistic director thing seems to sit on you very nicely. So looking forward to speaking to you.
Absolutely love it.
Yeah, well, great. And it comes across and lovely to speak with you, Catherine. That's Catherine Hunker there, artistic director of the Killaloe Music Festival. And you can find out more about what sounds like a very exciting festival indeed on killaloemusicfestival.com. And that is our lot for this evening here in Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. We'll talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio.